All right, we're going to have Chris come up in just a minute to join us to just give a quick introduction to where we are right now. We're in our last 2 weeks of our series on Cultivate that we've been doing this spring, which has been looking at some of Jesus's agricultural metaphors, primarily through the parables, to learn a bit about kingdom life and what life is like in Jesus's kingdom. We will be continuing that today, though we don't have a parable. We just have a couple verses from the end of Matthew 9. In which he talks about the need and the size of the harvest and the fact that there's very few workers. So we're going to work through those verses here this morning, and then we have next week, Becca is going to join us for our final sermon in this series. She's going to talk about the vine and the branches of Jesus. Very much looking forward to that, but thought it'd be a fun way to introduce the sermon today to have Chris come on up. As you might imagine, this was my other thing, Kevin, that I wanted to be a marine biologist, but I also wanted to be able to introduce kingdom concepts through spoken rap. I feel like I just missed that call, too, and just in praying diligently about it, I thought I'm probably not the right guy to deliver that message. So we're having Chris. Is this round two here at Westgate for you of doing a spoken word since the three? It's the round three. Okay, this is very Trinitarian of you. So this is exciting. All right, so Chris is going to get us into the talk today about the harvest and the workers and what it means for us to say yes to joining that harvest, and then we'll go from there. Thank you, Chris. It's all yours.
Thanks. And just as a little intro, spoken word is a mix of poetry, hip-hop, and storytelling. So you'll see a lot of elements kind of in different degrees. So, yeah, hope you enjoy. They say the grass is greener on the other side, but I don't think I believe it. See, the other day was a long day. You've had that before, right? And after this long work day turned into a long work week and with tired hands and feet, I was ready for some me time. And if all that wasn't enough, my wife has the audacity to ask me, "Can I have a back scratch?" Now, ordinarily, this would be no big deal, but I chose to bottle my emotions in the way that I feel. So in the pursuit of hiding, my expression began to reveal that I seemed to have misplaced my servanthood and zeal. For real. I was grumpy about giving her a back scratch. Now, I know it's not wrong for my energy to be in lack, but here's where I messed up and what got me off track. Instead of valuing what I value, I decided to slack, so let me let you in on a little but huge hack. See, there's a reason why that grumpy neighbor of yours is always yelling at you to get off my lawn. Because you have no idea how much work it took to make that front yard look like an absolute golf course. And though clearly your neighbor might lack in some interpersonal communication skills, there is one thing that they understand. They work for what they value. See, sometimes I lack in that department. I want to get my cardio up, but don't get the treadmill started. I want to give God my whole heart, but I don't offer all compartments. And I expect a gold medal when I train half-hearted. And then all the runners have departed. And I'm left without the things that I value because I don't treat them like I value them. And it makes no sense. Reaping with no sowing, that's a farmer who's a fool. Mending broken relationships without a needle or spool. Diving into family time without filling up the pool. See, I can't build upon my dreams if I don't pick up the tool. And bulking up without any training. Growing internally without any straining. Jesus at the center with no rearranging. See, I love spring and summer, but I hate when it's raining. And I want to learn from other people's perspectives that might be different from mine, but I close up the second I get uncomfortable like an oyster, as if my worldview is the pearl of great price. And then Jesus asks me, "Ye of little back scratches, would you like to think twice?" And the other day, I got my chance. See, I'd just woken up, I was a little tired, and my wife had asked me if she could show me a song that she had just heard. And although I was ready to get it going on my day with my schedule and my time, I decided I'm not going to miss this opportunity. So at 8:15 a.m., we clicked play and we danced to Leon Bridges. And I swear I could smell the fresh aroma of cut grass in that room. See, may we dance often. And maybe back scratch the same, because it's moments like this that add a log to the flame. Because if I don't value what I value, then it's only me to blame. And if I don't cultivate my own lawn, it will always stay the same. So do you treat the things you value with value? So may we lend ear to one another and make community conglomerate. And in our reaping, remember sowing, because they're not completely opposite. And go ask that grumpy neighbor of yours and probably bother him, because they know that the grass isn't greener on the other side. It's greenest where you water it.
That's like, that is literally amazing to me. I don't know all the gifts of the Spirit that are in the New Testament, but I'm quite certain that's one of them. Whatever that is. And Chris and I were talking before the service about how to connect that to the sermon a bit, and Chris was saying, you know, I think it's just, do we mean what we say? Will we enter into the harvest? Will we walk in this world the way that we're invited to walk? And then that brought up a question I had for Luke Vim, and so I never really like those shows. Sometimes it's movies, sometimes it's a Netflix episode or something, where it tells you sort of the end of the story at the beginning, and I always think, well, that's dumb. Now I know the end of the story, but somehow I still get pulled in throughout the entirety of that narrative. And so the end of our story today, and I was talking with Luke about this, is what it means to be a Christian. And Luke, who's smarter than I am, and that'll be demonstrated a few different ways during this sermon, but Luke, I said to you, I said, what is the origin, what is the etymology of being Christian? I assumed it was Latin or something. You're like, Peter, that's Greek. And can you just say, like, I can repeat it, but can you shout out loud what it means to be a Christian?
It means just to be a little Christ.
A little Christ, and you said a couple other words about that, too.
I did.
You did. I love that you have a less than one-year-old. You have no idea. Didn't you say something about being a little anointed one as well?
It's because Christ just means anointed. So the same Spirit that anointed Christ anoints each and every one of us who follow Christ.
Amen. And so, yeah, right? I know. Basically, I don't have any notes up here. I'm just going to keep calling on people to work through the rest of the sermon. It's really fun. So that's the end. That's what it means to participate in the harvest that we'll read about in just a little bit and being a Christian. But we have a ways to go to get there to sort of understand the context of Matthew 9 and the last few verses of this agricultural metaphor that Jesus uses. But as I was doing the prep this week, actually, I thought there's really not a great way for me to do this. It felt like I was going to be pulling teeth because there was so much content that to understand the end of Matthew 9, which we haven't even read yet, and I will in just a second, to understand it, we need a ton of context. We actually need almost the entirety of Matthew chapter 9 to understand then the last few verses when Jesus finally does invite people to join the harvest that is so significant and there's so much need for us as little Christ to be a part of it. I thought, you know, the failure rate of this sermon is roughly akin to my failure rate when I was introduced to parabolas in ninth grade geometry. which made no sense to me whatsoever, and I feel like I'm back in that spot with this sermon, because one of the things that we have to do is we have to understand some background information, just generally speaking, about a very common word that we probably know in our Christian faith, and that's that word salvation. Because what we'll see all throughout the ninth chapter of Matthew is salvation is in operation. Jesus's name means salvation, and there's all these pictures going on in Matthew 9 about salvation and how it's operating as Jesus is just moving through that early Mediterranean world. And at the end of seeing all of these pictures of salvation, he says, I want you to join me now in that process because the need is so great for salvation to be present in this world. So we're going to have to do some work on just the theological idea of salvation. Drink from the salvation fire hose is what it'll feel like this morning. And then we'll read all of Matthew chapter 9, or at least some of it. And then after that, it's going to get easier because we're going to see some pictures of salvation in Matthew 9, including demonic deliverance. That'll be an easy one to talk about. Physical healing. Yeah, that's not tricky. And of course, the internal transformation or the delivering and healing of our interior world as well, that is part of God's holistic salvation. So once again, I'm back to the parabola moment, and I'm pretty sure that we're going to fail on this. Taylor, although I've got something waiting for you in the sermon, so be ready. You and I might reconcile here in a little bit, and I'm quite excited about that. All right, so before we actually read the passage in Matthew 9, I want to do a little bit of work around kingdom. If you just remember the idea of kingdom, which is the primary idea of these parables and agricultural metaphors, it just simply means the place where God's will is known and done and accomplished. It's sort of where his government is, for lack of a better metaphor. This is where Jesus rules. This is where he reigns. And we see his ways of life embodied in the world around him as we're living life in his kingdom. Now, in light of that, let's at least put up Matthew 9, the last two verses to start with, because this is where the metaphor comes in. He says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and the healing of every disease and sickness. So this came before. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, the sheep without a shepherd. And then he goes into these again. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. And so Jesus is going around to all of these villages, all these towns, all these places, and he's just overwhelmed by the sheer volume of need that he sees. Seems to me like we live in a somewhat similar set of circumstances. I don't know about you, but I feel often quite overwhelmed, not even just by my own journey of God's ongoing salvation work in my life, but just seeing the need in the world around us. And Jesus is walking around that early Mediterranean world, and the need is everywhere. And we'll read about that again through the totality of Matthew 9. And it's almost he just with this great sense of crying out, could I please have some more people that can embody my salvation in the world and bring my good news to the people that are deeply in need. So with that in mind then, kind of as background, working through this idea of salvation, I can give you a very simple definition for salvation from the text, but then it'll take a little bit more explanation to work through, okay? So this is the start of drinking from the salvation fire hose, as it were. Salvation, just generally speaking from the Greek language, Luke, not Latin. It says it means to deliver from in order to heal and restore and make whole. Okay, it's to deliver from in order to heal and restore and make whole. Another way to say it is that in Jesus's kingdom, salvation is the operating energy that is continually delivering people, rescuing people, and restoring and healing people. But the thing about salvation is that it's always happening in present time and space. It's constantly happening within Jesus' kingdom. And for me, the way that I grew up, that idea of salvation being the operating energy of Jesus' kingdom that is constantly delivering us in a whole variety of ways and constantly healing and constantly restoring, that would have sounded really funny to me. Because the way that I grew up, salvation was always used in a very limited kind of way, a truncated kind of way, to describe something that was going to happen to me after I died. And if I had something called salvation, what that meant is maybe it was through infant baptism, or maybe it was through a sinner's prayer, or some other way in which we positioned ourselves properly for heaven and get out of hell. And that was what salvation meant in its totality. And that was something that was going to happen to me or you after we die. Now, I don't have time to get into the history of that notion. It's a very recent development in theological history to have salvation mean that, what I just described, meaning that you have to do some sort of decision, and then you get saved, and that means you get into heaven when you die. There's a lot of theological pivot points in the last 2,000 years that got us to that understanding. It's really fun in my classes where I teach at Northwestern and at Bethel. We inevitably end up talking about salvation, and students just mock me. And they say, "Kapsner, I've already had you in class. You say the same thing in every class about salvation." And I'm like, "I know." And until we can get our head around what salvation is, it's really hard to apply kingdom life to anything. And so we have to talk about what salvation means biblically, because dare I say, at the risk of having stones thrown at me by Tyler, would you ever throw stones? I feel like you're pretty compassionate. Anything to worry about right now for me? Okay, good. So dare I say, at the risk of sounding somewhat heretical but trying to be biblical, that salvation is always happening in current time and space, in that the Bible has a fuller and richer and, dare I say, much better news related to the good news of salvation than just something that happens for after we die. Like, maybe the good news is way better than we would ever hope to believe. So in light of that, I just want to one quick bracketing off here. That does not mean that there isn't some future time in which there will be competing kingdoms that are aligned against one another for all eternity. Okay? There is going to be, and there is currently, a kingdom of darkness that is aligned against the kingdom of light. And for eternity, there will be a kingdom of darkness in which people who are aligned against the realities of the kingdom of light will dwell and be. And conversely, there will be the kingdom of light in which Jesus' operating energy is at play. John Milton said this about heaven and hell in his famous poem, Paradise Lost. He said, the difference in the kingdoms is that in the there will be people who choose to want to reign in hell versus those who want to serve in heaven. The difference in the kingdoms. People choosing this idea, I will continue to rage against and rebel against. I will be God for eternity, and I will rage against. C.S. Lewis is aligned with that notion where he says that this kingdom of hell is locked from the inside. People have chosen it in their rebellion to continue to rage against God. And so the Bible does discuss these future times that sometimes we talk about in the church of heaven and hell, but it's never applying the word salvation to these concepts. Okay, salvation is something different. It's richer. It's fuller. It's in the present. It's the continuing operating energy that is delivering and restoring God's creation. So just a quick biblical survey of some of this. Are you familiar with the passage where it says to work out your what? Work out your what? Salvation. Work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for God is at work in you to will and to act according to his good purposes, right? Now, if you're familiar with that word tov, it's to the purposes of his tov. Okay? Work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for God is at work in you to will and to act according to the purposes that he has designed us to walk in. And all of that passage is happening in the present. Followers of Jesus, Christians, are meant to work out their salvation. And if that just means heaven and hell, how do you work that out in the present? This is a verse that would cause Martin Luther to sort of roll over in his grave, right? Work out your salvation in fear and trembling. A good paraphrase for that, I would suggest, is this. In your life as a Christian, continue to engage with God's delivering energy and do so with awesome reverence and sacred soberness. For the God of the universe is at work in you to bring healing and wholeness to your inner being, so that you are increasingly becoming consistent from the inside out with the ways of life that were embedded in this creation from the beginning. With sober, sacred soberness and awesome reverence, continue to work out God's ongoing delivering energy in your life. And if you do, it says you'll shine like stars in the midst of the darkness of this world. Theologians historically, when they talked about salvation, used this phrase. They said that I've been saved, I'm being saved, and I will be saved. Meaning that they're constantly working as followers of Jesus within the salvation of God, that if they have a heart of hatred or bitterness or won't scratch their wife's back, you pray and you just say, God, help me develop an actual heart from the inside out that delivers me from my self-absorption and creates in me an other-centered sort of agape way of doing life. That's salvation. I remember as a parent when our first children started coming into this world, I was not conflicted about how much I love the kids, but I was conflicted by my desire to continue forth in my career and felt like, gosh, I have so much energy put towards my career. And the kids felt like I loved them entirely, but it felt like kind of a responsibility. Like how many of you does it just make your soul come to life when you're like, I'm so glad I'm somebody else's responsibility? Awesome. Right? And I went to Hallie pretty early in our oldest, Caleb's life, and I said, you know, Hallie, let's say that I did all the right Christian things, meaning that I was there for all of Caleb's sports, and I was there for all of Caleb's activities, and I did all the right things as a dad, and I was a promise keeper, and all of these different things that were going on. I'm going to make those promises, and I'm going to do all of that. But do you think Caleb would know if I was doing them out of duty and responsibility or love? Even if I never failed once in my duty, do you think he would know? And I had to go to God and say, can you help me see my son the way that you might? Just purely through the eyes of love. And I'll never forget how much I needed to be delivered from my own sense of fear and self-absorption and worry about the future and all of these things. It was probably about a 3 or 4 month process. And then Caleb, I went into his room at a very early age, and he put his little fingers up on the crib, and he pulled his face up over the top of the crib, and I walked in, and I saw him, and I just stood there in the threshold of the room, and I sat and just wept with joy for my son. And in that moment, salvation had come. I was saved from the self-absorption and brought into the kingdom of light, where Jesus' energy is always operating to continue to deliver and restore. Other biblical examples, are you familiar with Miriam in Exodus after they're delivered from Egypt? She has this song that she sings where they're delivered from the enslavement to Egypt and they're brought into the new community and restored as the community of the Israelites. And what does she sing about? She sings that the salvation of God has come, delivered and restored. Isaiah 12, the prophet says that in his fear, the comfort of God came. Surely God is my salvation. Operating in fear, needing to be delivered from that and healed and restored and living within the comfort of God. When David kills Goliath, it's a salvation moment. When Esther intercedes for her people, it's a salvation moment. Salvation means to deliver and to restore. Are you familiar with the teaching from Matthew 16? So we keep drinking from the fire hose. When it says, Jesus says something like, if you want to find your life, you're going to have to lose it. Right? If you try to gain your whole life, you're going to lose it. But if you want to find your life, you're going to need to lose it and follow me. In the word life there, the word is psuche, and it means sort of what makes me fully human from the inside out. If you want to find the full humanity for which you were meant, created by God, you're going to have to give up your life and follow Jesus. If you decide to hold on to that and create that life for yourself, surely you're going to lose it. You'll become increasingly unrecognizable as an image bearer. But if you lose it for his sake, you'll surely find it. N.T. Wright says that when we decide to follow Jesus, that our inner person is being renewed by the Spirit day by day to become increasingly that which we were designed to be, free from the power of sin in our life. We were talking in the green-blue room. I don't know what color it is in the room beforehand, but somebody brought up a story. Most men are colorblind. Did you know that? So don't believe them. If they say that's that color, just say, no, it's not. And then you can really mess with them because it might be, and you just lie to them. So... that doesn't feel like salvation energy, actually. So I was in the green-blue room beforehand, and somebody brought up a story, and they said, you know, I know a story of a friend who, when he began following Jesus, he began to go from a sense of just experiencing the world all in a dull shade of gray, and colors suddenly became vivid, and taste became heightened, and his sense of sound began to be enlivened. A bit. I know for sure that as my heart has become less encumbered by my own self-centeredness in my life, that one of the things that replaces it is just an easy sense of wonder in the world around us. I was up on our chicken coop this past couple weeks ago. These designer chickens, I tell you what, I'm sure the average cost of any egg we get from them is $4,000, okay? So if you want a dozen eggs, I've got just 50 grand, just Venmo it. It'll be fine. So I'm up painting the roof of the covered run for the chickens, and I look down, and what do I see? I see a nest full of baby cardinals. Right? And my friend was like, you have to solve the mystery. Are they actually red? And Kevin, what did I say? You're the one that asked. And I said, nope, they're like little fuzzy, beautiful little creatures. And the mama cardinal and the daddy cardinal just kept swooping around me, and I just sat there in just this amazing sense of wonder watching life just come forth. And as my heart became more unencumbered by the fears of this world, I could enter into the wonder of the kingdom with an unencumbered heart and just sit there with the cardinals. And it was brilliant. Maybe one more that we can do, two more, for sure one. Romans 6:23, let's try that one, right? Anybody familiar with this passage? Okay, I'll start it, we'll see if you can finish it. Because this for sure is a verse that teaches us how to get into heaven and get out of hell, right? Okay, all right, so let's try. For the wages of sin is?
Death.
You all went to Awana, this is so fun. The wages of sin is death, but the free gift is? Eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Okay. So the interpretation of that verse for sure is basically the result of your sin is you go to hell, and the free gift is you go to heaven. Except it doesn't say that in the Greek. Uh-oh. Okay. It's all happening in the present tense. And when it says that the wages of sin is death, the Greek word for death there is not hell. There's a perfectly good word for hell in the Greek, and Paul doesn't use it. He uses the Greek word thanatos. And thanatos in the Greek means a misery of the soul that arises from sin in the present. It's a life that is characterized by sadness and grief and anger and rage and hatred and hopelessness and increasing stiff neck and hard heart. It's a life in which we become increasingly less what we are meant to be as sin does its work. The wages of our sin is thanatos. Equally so on the other side of it, everlasting life is commonly understood to be a synonym for heaven, except there's a perfectly good word in the Greek for heaven, and it's not everlasting life. Everlasting has the idea of indestructibility and life. I've taught from the pulpit before here. It's the Greek word zoe, and it simply means the kind of life that God himself enjoys and starts giving to his creation. It's a life of love and joy and peace and patience and goodness and kindness. As we abide in the vine that is Jesus, we begin to grow in the very divine life of God. And the invitation of Romans 6:23 is to partner with Jesus to say, yes, I will follow you. I will lose my suke and give it to you. And in return, God gives us his zoe and begins to explode in our life. And we begin to actually be like little Christ, little anointed ones. The result of our sin is a misery of the soul, but there's a free gift waiting for everybody. Without it cost the God of heaven everything and the free gift of grace to say, but I welcome you back into my way of life. You can have it, just ask. And it happens in the now. One more quick thing, and then we'll move into the entirety of the passage on that. There's an interesting thing that the Bible teaches about the sequence of salvation, just how it operates in our lives, the sequence of it. Salvation, biblically speaking, tends to start with our inner person and then ends with our outer person. And I talked about this just briefly in passing a couple weeks ago. Starts with our inner person and ends with our outer person. Are you familiar with the passage where it says that though our outer person is decaying, our inner person is what? Being renewed day by day. That's salvation. And the sequence is that our inner person gets renewed day by day, and the last thing that gets renewed is our physical body. It's part of why it says that Jesus will reign until all things are under his feet, and the last thing to put under his feet is death. And so we experience our salvation of our physical bodies by going through the waters of death, which is no different than what we have to go through when we go through the salvation of our inner person in an ongoing way. I had to die to self-absorption and self-centeredness, and so much death had to be crucified and had to die. But as I die, life comes, right? And the one thing that gives me some confidence that life will come on the other side of the physical death is the fact that I've experienced the death to life of God's salvation in the now in my inner person. And becoming a genuine person of wonder and love, hopefully increasingly in this world, gives me confidence that when I have to go through that void at the end that is so terrifying, and walking through those waters of death, life will greet me there too. And where I've been so imperishable, I will what? I will be raised imperishable. This is the witness of the text. This is all salvation. It's the totality of what God is talking about. So with that, is that enough? Should we do more? That's probably enough. We should just move on. No, that's okay. Salvation's all over the text. And the point is that it's happening in the present, and it's God's ongoing energy. And in Matthew 9, we see it all throughout Jesus' activity and teaching and ministry. I'm just going to read you a little bit from Matthew 9 now. Where we see him at work. And what does Jesus' name mean? It means salvation. So salvation is operating all throughout the Middle Eastern world, and as it does, certain things are happening. So again, I'll just give you a few snippets from Matthew 9, and that'll give us context for the rest of his teaching. Jesus stepped into a boat, crossed over, and came to his own town. Some men brought to him a paralyzed man lying on a mat. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the man, "Take heart, son, your sins are forgiven." At this, some of the teachers of the law said this fellow is blaspheming. But knowing their thoughts, Jesus said, "Why do you entertain evil thoughts in your hearts? Which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or get up and walk? But I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins." So he said to the paralyzed man, "Get up, take your mat, and go home." And the man went up and went home. Jesus had dinner at Matthew's house. Tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus said, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick. Remember, he's the great physician. He delivers and heals. Go and learn what this means, he says. I've come for not for the righteous, but for sinners. I've come to heal and restore for those people who are sick. While he was saying this, the synagogue leader came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did the disciples. But just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, remember 12, came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If only I touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned to her and said, "Take heart, daughter, your faith has healed you." When Jesus entered the synagogue leader's house and saw the noisy crowd and people playing pipes, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but she is just asleep." But then he took the girl by the hand and she got up. As Jesus went from there, two blind men followed him. "Have mercy on a son of David." "Do you believe that I'm able to heal you?" said Jesus. "Yes, Lord," they replied. "According to your faith, let it be done to you." And their sight was restored. And while they were going out, a man who was demon-possessed and could not talk was brought to him. And when the demon was driven out, the man who had been mute spoke, and the crowd was amazed. Nothing has ever been seen like this in all of Israel. Jesus then went through the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and the healing of every disease and sickness. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And he said to his disciples, his followers, his Christians, his little Christ, his anointed ones, he said to them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are so few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to please send out more workers into this harvest field." You just saw the demonstration of the totality of God's salvation all everywhere I walked. Come join me in that. This is what you're called to do. This is what Chris was getting to in his spoken word. But that does raise a few questions, most of which I'm not comfortable answering this morning. So the last few implications of this part of this invitation to join the harvest. As I said, I mean, clearly there's stuff in this passage with which I'm comfortable in my faith journey, specifically like the healing of my inner self. I'm very comfortable talking about the idea that I need to be delivered from maybe a sense of subtle deceit that spins the room in the favor just so people will like you. I'm sure nobody else ever does that. Or again, some of the things that I talked about in terms of self-absorption or just worried about my own sense of reputation, those kinds of things that just keep us in bondage and turn us into things that we're not meant to be, filled with an unencumbered heart. Those sorts of things, the forgiveness of sins that is part of salvation, that is our healing and deliverance from, those things I think we're all somewhat familiar with as believers and meant to call in or to walk in. But demonic possession, what? I don't know what to do with this. Okay, we see it here. I'm not comfortable teaching about this. I think we'll let Kevin teach about that when he comes back. Because, you know, I was thinking, I don't know if Luke's in here somewhere. I know we were texting before the service. Becca's here, and they're part of the teaching team. And I think Luke and Becca and I really screwed up these 7 weeks that Kevin's been away, because we're the mice, and we could have set up any number of things for the feline to have to deal with when he comes back. Demonic possession being one of them. Maybe you have different experiences than me. I don't know. I can just say a couple, and I truly don't know what to do with this kind of thing. I really don't, so I'm not comfortable teaching it. I just know that at one point in my life, I have seen an exorcism firsthand, and to this day, I can't explain what I saw. And I don't know how to categorize it. I don't know how to operate in that realm. I just saw something that I can't explain. Another story I have from that is one of my dearest and most trusted mentors that I had in my life. He was part of founding KTIS Radio, and we were meeting one day, and he was just a very subdued man, a man of very few words, no charisma, no, he just wasn't what you would think. And he had to leave the meeting that we were in, and I asked him where he was going. He goes, "I'm going to an exorcism." It's like, what? What are you talking about? You're like 110 years old to begin with. Like, what? And then he said this. He said, "The exorcism is in Wayzata." And I went, "What? There's no demons in Wayzata. They're like in Africa and South America. Lake Minnetonka keeps them all out. You need to know that." I know I see it in Matthew 9. I genuinely don't know what to do with it. So again, Airport Kev is going to have to teach that one. That was a salvation moment for Airport Kev, too, wasn't it? That's a great story. Physical healing is the second of three things that we see in this passage that I just referenced as we wrap things up, and this one's a lot harder. It's a trickier topic. It would definitely benefit from a lot of weeks of teaching. It's another topic, just like demonic possession, I don't know what to do with. So I have a few comments maybe that you could think through or wonder about or wrestle with, talk with your families, just kind of walk out these things that I hope are reliable comments, but it isn't going to teach about what physical healing can or can't be because I don't know for sure, but I can give you some biblical underpinnings and principles of that. The first thing is to acknowledge the presence of mystery in terms of how and when and why God acts in physical healing. We're not God, and we don't know. And part of what faith asks of us is to be comfortable in the mystery of not being God. That's what it means to serve in heaven and not reign in hell. Let's be comfortable in the mystery of who God is and not define our faith by what we know to put God in the judgment seat somehow. Where we're the judge and he's not. But there's some other things that I thought about that are a complete mystery to me, you know, that this is just part of how God operates. One picture that I thought is just a picture of some things that we're noticing in the telescopes of light from the Hubble spacecraft. We'll put it up now. I mean, I didn't create that. I have no idea how. Right? I mean, this is within God's purview, a bit of mystery. I have no idea how he did this. I was texting with my family this week. I said, you know, I need some animals that just defy logic, and they defy explanation. Like in the mammal kingdom, there's certain things that I would have no idea how to create or even why. The first one that came up was from my daughter, Anna. She said a platypus. So it's like, it can live in water, out of water. Is it a duck? Is it a beaver? What is this thing? I have literally no idea. So I sat totally mystified by the platypus, but then my mind started wandering a little bit. And I thought, you know, there's other mammals that are a complete and total mystery to me about how and when and why God created them. See, Taylor, I see my favorite mammal is the elephant that never forgets. And I remember that Petey deal, like maybe 3 years ago, where you called me Petey from up here. But I felt like maybe this is our chance for some reconciliation between you and me. Like, I know how much you wanted to hug me up here before, and I'm just going to welcome it now. No, yeah, right now, right. The dividing, I think in Ephesians, it says the dividing wall of hostility between worship pastor and speaking guy broken down. Wait, it's happening again? Oh, no. Oh, now I do need therapy again. You're the best. All right, so thought number one of four about this idea of physical healing is that there is some mystery involved. Another one, more serious and significant now, related to this that is worth saying, is that when there is an illness that is part of our lives and potentially a terminal illness in people that we love, the test is severe. The test of that is severe. An illness like that can feel like all throughout the day sort of an inescapable shadow, can't it? Just sort of looms over the entirety of the day. And if it's an illness unto death, the pain and the sorrow and the grief is obviously immense, and the questions of God that come from that are completely understandable. And sometimes, as I was thinking about this, the void and the grief and the loss is so deep that it scars us for a lifetime. Why didn't he heal? In fact, I think anytime we lose somebody in this life, it scars us. Even when we celebrate a life well-lived, if somebody dies at an old age, we feel their void, don't we? It leaves a mark. There's people that have passed in my life that I really wish I could still talk to today, even though it was a life well lived. Other times the scars run even deeper. I remember a family friend of mine, a dear friend that I used to do ministry with in another location, and he was a dad of three young kids, and he had had a heart transplant some 10 years prior. And it was time now. His heart had begun to calcify and harden, and he needed another heart transplant. And there was no heart available, but if he would go down and just stay at the University of Minnesota, that maybe he would be there if a heart did become available. And he was in the U of M for 9 months in a hospital room. 9 months. And then one day, I'll never forget, they got the word, and it was a sad word, a grief-filled word, but also a word simultaneously with hope, because somebody had passed away and a heart was now available. And of course, what do we say in those moments, as we should? Oh gosh, the test is over. Finally, we're going to be able to walk into some new life. And so they did the operation. He got the new heart. The sense of the test and the severity of the test was over. And things looked promising, but then his body rejected that heart and he passed. And it was awful and stunning. And that kind of test is severe. Again, like walk away from God severe is how we end up feeling, understandably so. Maybe a couple things on which you can hang your hat related to this. I think it's always really helpful to remember that the Bible never says anything other than that in this world we will have trouble and our tears are not going to be wiped away in this life. It does promise that our tears will be wiped away when the King returns. That's when our tears get wiped away. That's the hope that we profess. But it doesn't mean that everything is going to be restored here the way that we want it. The other thing that we can hang our hat on is that God's compassion and his faithfulness will be there in the midst of all of us. It'll never leave us in any circumstance ever. God is a shepherd who will be there every step of the way forever and ever and ever. And what we learn about compassion comes right out of Matthew 9. It says in Matthew 9, 35 and 36 that Jesus had compassion on them. When he saw the entirety of the need, he had compassion on them. Now, I can't say this word. I don't know how, but I found out this morning that it's another word that Luke knows how to say. So, Luke, can you give us the pronunciation for this? Thank you. It literally means from the deep sense of compassion, from the bowels of Jesus. It's not just an obligation that he felt, but it was a deep sense of empathy that demanded action. And so when Jesus sees the need that we have and share, he has this compassion that will result in action. If not now, sometime when he returns. Third of four things, why does he heal some and not others? We have to be very careful to not buy into the idea that it's the strength of our faith that activates his healing. Okay? We have to be very careful with the idea that it's not the strength of our faith that activates his healing. Another story I know of a family, they had a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, and the mom got cancer. And they were counseled, understandably so, to say, don't even say the word cancer, just have enough faith, don't give it a foothold, just have enough faith, and she'll be fine, and she died. And guess whose fault it was that she died, that didn't have enough faith? 10 and the 6-year-old, and the widower. Because Jesus is not giving us a formula in Matthew 9 about how to have the right amount of faith to activate the healing that we desire. What's going on in Matthew 9 is he's showing us his government. He's showing us his way of life. He's showing us that to participate in his government is to have faith. And the fact that the woman who was healed of that blood disease was for 12 years, she was experiencing that. For the Jews of that time, that word 12 would have been very significant why it was 12. Because there's 12 tribes, there's 12 disciples. The number 12 just simply means the totality of Jesus' government. And what he's talking about here is that faith is always the operating energy of the kingdom in which salvation is in my government. He's trying to persuade the Jewish people, Matthew is, it's written to Jews, to persuade them that he really was the king of the kingdom. And so he's showing that he's not giving us a formula about how to make something happen. That connects us to the last thing, that even if we do get healed, we are going to die. Right? So this is not God showing favor to some to give them a few extra years of life versus others. This is not what the Bible is teaching about healing in the least. You see, when healing happens, if it doesn't happen to us, the fact that it even exists, and it's very clear in the text, I even read some of the passages, that it demonstrates the power and the wonder of his kingdom to give everybody who sees it confidence that he is the God of salvation. He doesn't heal and do a favor to somebody and not heal and do no favor to somebody else just because of some strength of faith. Anytime we were to see a healing, it's always reflective of the fact that his kingdom is real and that a salvation will occur. And everybody who bears witness to it can have confidence that his kingdom is real, whether we get healed or not. Those are some hooks on which to hang our hats about healing, which is a tricky subject. We need to say a lot more about it, but I hope that's helpful. That it's not about our faith that activates healing or doesn't, or the strength of our prayer, or what we mean, or the level of intercession, and it isn't that God likes some and not others. It simply is, for some, a demonstration of the totality of his kingdom to bear witness to the ongoing work of salvation that he has in this world. One last piece. This is the one with which I'm more familiar, and we'll wrap it up here. It's the ongoing salvation of the inner person. I think to the extent that we can do away with a Christian mindset of duty and obligation and responsibility, like we're supposed to do things to somehow prove to God that we're grateful that he died on the cross or something like that, but actually enter into becoming a disciple, a follower of Jesus. Jesus never, ever, ever says once, "Why don't you all hang out here while I do the cross thing so I can get you into heaven when you die?" He doesn't say it once. You know what he says 93 times throughout the Gospels? "Follow me. Come follow me. Follow me. Drop your nets, follow me. Get out from under that tree, follow me. Become a Christian, a follower of Jesus, and if you do, I will teach you the ways of my life from the inside out. I will give you the authority and the power of the salvation of my kingdom, because I need way more people than just me. The harvest is huge. Will you learn my ways of life? Will you grow in them? You're not going to be good in them at first." The disciples were pretty terrible at it all, weren't they, when they first started? I don't know why we make discipleship so confusing. Like, as soon as you say yes to following Jesus, you're going to be great at it. Like, is there anything in life that you say yes to at first that you're good at? I mean, my first ever golf round was like 265 shots. If you wanted to become a blacksmith, you're not going to hoof that horse just right away, right? It's like anything else. It takes time. You will grow in the wisdom and the power and the authority of the kingdom. We become like little Jesuses from the inside out. And this is what he's inviting us into, to be the representatives of salvation. As we close here, I'll put a quote from Dallas Willard up on the screen. It's one of my favorite quotes. He talks about why bother with discipleship. Highly recommend reading this very short article. Again, it's titled, "Why Bother with Discipleship?" He says, "Finally, for the one who makes sure to walk as close to Jesus as possible, there comes the reliable exercise of a power that is beyond them in dealing with the problems and evils that afflict earthly existence. Jesus is actually looking for people he can trust with his power. He knows that otherwise we remain largely helpless in the face of organized and disorganized evils around us and unable to promote his will for good in this world with adequate power. He is the one who said, 'I have given say over all things in heaven and earth, so you go.' Of him it was said that God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Ghost and with power, who went about doing good and healing all that were oppressed of the devil, for God was with him. We are called to do his work by his power." Whether that's scratching our wife's back, asking for wisdom about how to deal with the mental illness of our time, working through matters of sexuality and clarity about who God is, walking through our own self-absorptions and our fears and our idolatries, God's salvation energy is around us all the time, always to deliver and restore until one day we set it all down and are welcomed home. Would you stand? Just a couple of announcements. One, even connected to this Workers in the Harvest, I really like it. Mama Betty is somebody that we've partnered with for a while, the ministry in Tanzania. We have some students who have been there, and she is available after the service in the West Lobby right over here. Please go greet her as a person who has been faithfully working in that version of the Harvest. There's also a couple meetings happening. One is a budget meeting that's happening in the community room. It's a question and answer, and the other one is a brunch in the fellowship hall, and of course, there's people here that are here to pray with you around whatever you have. I can't highly recommend enough using that resource for the burdens that we carry to come forward and just receive prayer. Let's just pray together then as we close. God, within all of the mystery of this and the wonder about it and even Chris's wonderful admonition to mean what we say, teach us with your power and your grace and your wonder and your love how to operate even more beautifully as the stars that shine in this world, filled with your life and your salvation energy. Bring your Zoe into our suke so that we can reflect you beautifully into this world. By the power of the Spirit, we pray. Amen. And then blessings as you go.